Show Me the Science with Professor Luke O'Neill.
Hello, Luke O'Neill here, and welcome to my show, Me the Science podcast. This week, it's the science of longevity. Now, I was going to call it the science of why we die, but that seems a bit gloomy. I did one recently on what happens in your brain when people have died and you bring them back, you know, that kind of thing. But this is a bit different because there's been some very interesting stuff on what determines when you're going to die. Now, longevity, of course, has been a big issue, the aging process, and how can we encourage healthy aging, and it's a very hot topic at the moment, not least because we're all living to be older anyway. I read recently in Japan, they're the ones we look at, the demographic shift is remarkable. There's so many people in Japan over 60 now, and they aren't being replaced because, for some reason, the Japanese aren't getting it on, as they say, and the Japanese government had encouraged this because they're really worried about it. So it's a very interesting topic anyway in terms of how, that's kind of philosophical. Like, why would I die at the age of 70 and you at 80? Does it run in families? What's the basis for the age you might die at? Now, you can go into websites and fill them in, and it'll predict rather soberingly how long you're going to live. And I had reason to do that, so I gave it a go for this. I said, why don't I do that? And I went into one of these and I filled in various things about my health and my weight and exercise. I have to be honest, of course, how much exercise you take and whether you drink or smoke and all those things. I guess actuaries do this the whole time. And the good news is it's telling I'm going to live to be 85. Now, I may have lied in answering some of the questions, but actually, to be honest, I messed as a true scientist, I messed around with it. I put myself in as a smoker. I don't smoke, right? That took 5 years off the projection, for example, because we know smoking's bad. So you can do this. You can try to figure out when it is you're going to, how long you're going to live. And the big question there is how much of it is genetics. Now, we know it's partly genetic because longevity does run in families. You often hear of people living to be 90 and then the next generation lives to be 90. But it's very hard to separate the environment there from genetics because maybe the parent brings up the child to be healthy, you know, and then they're going to live longer anyway, you know. So the genetic bit's been very difficult to pin down. And there was one Danish study. They looked at 2,700 sets of twins. And twins are very useful here because you can look at identical twins who have the same genes or fraternal twins who don't and just see what the difference is in terms of how long they live for. The assumption being that they're probably in the same environment, in the same family growing up and so on. And they reckon it was 25% genetic. The rest is environmental. So there is something to do your genes that allows you to live longer, but a huge amount of it's to do with how you live your life and the environment. And of course, we know this because smoking will definitely shorten your life. So does obesity. They're two huge risk factors for decreasing lifespan. If you drink a lot, that's another big negative as well, of course, for in terms of decreasing your lifespan. But it's variable. There's statistics in this. Some people we well know smoke their heads off and live to be 90. So they must have a different set of genes to allow them to resist the damaging effects of the cigarette smoke. And the great phrase I use a lot in these podcasts is nature via nurture. You reveal that through the nurture and then the nature is there. But on average, smoking will shorten your life. So remember, the environmental impact then is quite dramatic. But what I want to talk about today is studies in a worm. Now, these worms are called nematodes. Is the name of them. They're microscopic worms. They're 1 millimeter long. The Linnaean name for them is Caenorhabditis elegans. And they turn out to be a very interesting organism to study on this topic. Now, you might wonder, why would you look at worms? Especially microscopic worms, we're very different to them. But you know, we're not that different. We share many genes. Worms eat like we do. They burn glucose. They burn fats. They've got a mouth and a digestive system. They've got a nervous system. So they've got overlaps with us and all these things. Their cells have mitochondria, like our cells do. So they became what's known as a model organism to study the complexities of living systems, because you can study them very easily. And the credit goes to a scientist called Sydney Brenner. Now, Sydney Brenner worked in Cambridge for most of his life. He's famous. He passed away a few years ago. But he's famous for discovering messenger RNA. Now, mRNA is the intermediary between DNA and proteins. So DNA, as I hope you all know, is the recipe for life. It makes proteins, and proteins do all the things in your body. But mRNA is the intermediate. Sydney gets the credit, one of the guys who discovered that. And also for helping to crack the genetic code, how you instruct the body to make mRNA and then to make proteins. He worked with Francis Crick a lot. And he won the Nobel Prize, of course, for all of this, partly. But he was the one who said, having worked out the genetic code, he said, I want to work on more complex things, and I want to work on the complexity of how animals develop from a single cell, and the whole process of how cells divide and how they form organs, and that the big question in biology. And Sydney in the 70s, I think it was, said, let's work on that. And he decided to work on these nematodes. And I don't know how he came across them, to be honest, but he picked them as a way to study these complexities. And one reason is he gave for this was they're easy to grow. They've got a short generation time. So each generation only lasts a short space of time, really, a week or two. And then they die, you know. And then he said, let's study that. There's an animal to study death in, right? Because obviously if they're dying after 2 weeks, could we understand more about the death process? But equally, the whole business of cells dividing and forming organs, because it's all so fast, you could study them. The second thing that's good about them is they're transparent. You can use a microscope to see them, and you can see through them, and you can see all the cells moving and where the cells go. And he suggests them. I think the first nematodes that he studied were isolated from rotting mushrooms. Now, there's a strange thing. They live on various dead vegetation, and they're the ones he began studying first. Now, his influence was massive. Many scientists follow Sydney's lead because he was such a bit of a genius, of course. And one scientist in particular, John Sulston, in Cambridge, he works with Brenner, and he decides to track all the cells in the nematode as they divide and grow. And it turns out the adult nematode only has 900 cells. Now, in our bodies, we have billions of cells, and it's very hard to follow all those, but he could track the 900 cells that make up the adults. It was a painstaking process. He would look down his microscope, you know, the fertilized egg divides, now you have two. Eventually, you've got a full nematode, and there's 900 cells. He could track them all. And I met him once, because I did a postdoc in Cambridge. I remember I went to lunch one day, and he was in the canteen, and my supervisor said to me, that guy sitting over there, do you know what he does all day? I said, what? He looks down his microscope and he counts the cells in worms. That's all he does. And we both said, why the hell would you do that? It seems like a ridiculous thing. But Sulston discovered the genetic basis for cell death, because when the worm is growing, you get less than 900. I think you get 1,200 cells, but you prune them back to 900 in a very specific process to sculpt the worm. And he was able to find genes that were responsible for those cells dying. And he called them SED genes, CED. And that stands for Caenorhabditis elegans, death genes. And these genes get flipped, and now certain cells die, and now you get the final 900 cells. It's a bit like a sculptor is, you know, carving away at things to form the final sculpture of a human, say whatever it is. So he was able to define these genes. Now, guess what? We have the same genes in our bodies. So cell death in our bodies does involve similar genes, and they were discovered first in nematodes. And of course, if they go weird or wacky, you might get cancer, because cells don't die and they become immortalized. So this was a great example of Sydney's idea. Let's study this in worms. We might find stuff interesting anyway. And lo and behold, it's in humans as well. And Sulston won the Nobel Prize for this cell death process. It's called apoptosis, by the way, that type of cell death, and Sulston gets part of the credit for discovering it from studying these worms. So it's a very interesting thing that out of looking at worms and cells down a microscope, you could find this. Now, they also discovered in this process that worms can be very sociable, these microscopic worms. They get together occasionally, have a worm party, if you will. And again, that was genetic. If you knock out certain genes in the worm, they become antisocial. Now, isn't that fascinating? So maybe the basis for social activity in humans is partly genetic. Wouldn't that be incredible? So we're learning a lot of complex traits, we call them, by studying these worms and what they do. Now, but getting to the substantive issue that I want to talk about, they live for 2 weeks, these worms, and they die. And but they noticed, the worm specialists, if you deplete them of food, right, sometimes you get rid of their nutrients and make them hungry, they fall into a sleep-like state. It's called a dour state, D-A-U-E-R, if you want to look it up. And then they can live in that dour state for as much as 2 months. Now, isn't that incredible? So in other words, they can turn into this, if you like, this into a sort of semi-sleep state. And then when the food is back again, this happens in the wild, I suppose. So the food might build up again in the wild because the wind blows in some nutrients. And then they get released from the dour state, and then they eventually die, of course. Now, guess what? That was genetic. And they found genes in the worm that put them into this dour state, right? And then they can live for 2 months. And those genes then were linked into longevity. And amazingly, if it was us humans, let's say food runs out and we go into a dire state, we could live for 300 years is the equivalent. Like Rip Van Winkle, not a bad analogy here. And then incredible. So in other words, if we could crack this in humans, we could go into this state. This could be useful for traveling to Mars maybe. But still, it's a fascinating business that these worms can go into this state and live for the equivalent of 300 years. Now, again, they find the gene that governs that. They name it AGE1. AGE1 for aging. And if you mutate that gene in the worm, it'll live even longer. And in fact, what they showed was the mutation in AGE1 would double the lifespan of the worm simply by targeting a single gene. Now, again, that's a remarkable thing. A single gene changing, allowing a worm to double its lifespan. Now, do we humans have it? Indeed, we do. They've found equivalents of AGE1 in humans. And what does this gene do? It codes for a protein that can repair DNA. Now, one theory behind aging is, as we get older, our DNA gets more and more damaged. And then eventually it gets so damaged that we die, right? Age 1 can fix damaged DNA. The mutant is really good at better than the other, the normal type, at fixing the DNA. So in other words, you're living longer, at least the worm is, because you're fixing the damage to the DNA. And then it turns out that in humans, it could be about DNA damage as well. And if we can keep fixing our DNA as we age, maybe we'll double our lifespan. Now, that's not, we're a long way off that, and we're actually more complex than the worms. But still, there's the prospect now of allowing that to happen. And so that just shows you this can be a big genetic component into longevity, as well as the environmental component. And now lots of work is going on into these worm pathways that were discovered in worms. And now do they apply to us humans, and will they determine our lifespan? Now, they have tried already to look for genes that would, variants of genes that link into aging. And there was one study done of over 36,000 adults. And they study these over time. And they notice something very interesting. A healthy lifestyle extends your lifespan. And these were people over the age of 65. And they could. There are genes, genetic variants they'd found that might predict you dying younger. It was called a high genetic risk group. And if those people had that higher risk than others of dying younger because of genetics, if they lived a healthy lifestyle, their life was lengthened by 3.84 years. So almost 4 years longer if they changed into a healthy lifestyle, if they were at risk of dying a bit younger. Now, the ones who had low genetic risk, and again, they could group these, and they changed into a healthy lifestyle, they live for over 4 years longer. So what this tells us is there's genetics there that would predispose you to dying a bit younger. But if you have a healthy lifestyle, you can extend your lifespan, even if you have these genetic risk factors. Now, what are the genes? That's difficult to say. There's 11 genes have been found. It's not quite clear what they do and how they link into aging. But if you carry certain versions of those, you're at risk of dying slightly younger. But if you change your lifestyle, you can live a bit longer. And the two big genes that were found, they're called APOE and FOXO3A. There's variants in those that will predict you dying younger. What do? They protect your heart. And if you carry different variants, it keeps your heart going for longer. Now, heart disease is a big cause of death, obviously, in humans. So they found those two genes already, and they're trying to fit that into the picture. But the bottom line from this is quite remarkable in my view. These nematodes, you can alter genes in them to allow them to live longer, first and foremost. They seem to be tied into nutrition, because if food is scarce, they can go into this dire state. But there's a genetic component in aging in worms. And if you modify the genes, they can live to be 300 years old, the equivalent. And then as humans, there are these genetic links into aging, but your lifestyle choice will combine with those genes to increase your chance of living longer. And what this means is it's never too late. And that big study of 36,000 people, there was people over 65 who changed their lifestyle. And they were given almost 4 years longer life, because obviously they followed them for a number of years. So again, very interesting that we can extend our lifespan, even if we're at risk of dying younger, by changing our lifestyle. And it's a combination of the environment and the genes that determines this. So it's complicated, but I hope you managed to follow what I was saying there, and I hope you got something interesting from the science of longevity. And thanks as ever for listening. You're all very welcome to listen. And of course, as I always say, send me in any ideas. Happy to cover topics if I can. And of course, my podcast is available for download every Thursday, and it's a News Talk production.